Thank you very much. I would like to now introduce our speaker. He is Fred Sossman, and I'll read a little about him, and then I'm just going to turn it over to him. Fred is a native of Greenville, Tennessee. He's the senior writer, executive assistant to the president for public affairs, and associate professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University. He holds a BA in English and history and an MA in English from ETSU. He writes a food column for the Kingsport Times News and is a frequent contributor to the Marquee magazine. His stories about food and Southern culture are often heard on Inside Appalachia, a weekly radio program produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting. The first volume in his book series, The Place Setting, Timeless Tastes of the Mountain South from Bright Hope to Frog Level, was published in March 2006 by Mercer University Press in Macon, Georgia, and a second volume followed in March 2007. In 2007, the first volume won a national award. The American Association of University Presses and the American Library Association named it one of the best books of the year for public and secondary school libraries, along with books published by the University of California, Duke University, Georgetown, Temple, and Yale Universities. He is now working on a third volume in the Place Setting series, scheduled for publication in the spring of 2009. Fred contributed the introductory essay on Appalachian foodways for the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, published in August 2007 by the University of North Carolina Press, and his work appears in the Encyclopedia of Appalachia from the University of Tennessee Press. He has written about Southern culture for Blue Ridge Country Magazine, Bluegrass Unlimited, the Mississippi Encyclopedia, the Encyclopedia of Alabama, and Crossroads, a Southern Culture Annual. His work has also been included regularly in Cornbread Nation, The Best of Southern Food Writing, a series of books published by the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi, the University of North Carolina Press, and the University of Georgia Press. Fred has been selected as the editor of Cornbread Nation 5, the Best of Southern Food Writing, to be published in 2010 by the University of Georgia Press. He is also a creator of the book Home and Away, A University Brings Food to the Table, published by ETSU in 2000. And please welcome Fred Sossman to...
Thank you, Nancy, and thanks to the TLA for your tremendous hospitality and also to the staff here at MetaView for being so accommodating. I'm going to take you on a little hayride, a romp through my part of Appalachia. Call this Dip Dogs, Arville Burgers, and Beans All the Way. Hayriding what I call the Red Hot Dog Corridor. And for those of you from Middle and West Tennessee, you are in the Red Hot Dog Corridor, so welcome. First of all, let me share a little Tennessee secret that not a lot of people know about. The moon pie, which is one of our most celebrated Southern icons, celebrated its 90th birthday last year. And if y'all don't know about moon pies and microwaves, take this bit of knowledge home with you if you don't remember anything else from my talk today, and share the gospel of moon pies and microwaves. Microwaves are good for a few things. I'm in your way, I think. Popping popcorn, dealing with pepperoni rolls, which I'll show you in a minute, and microwaving moon pies. Now, if you're familiar with a moon pie, you know a moon pie is matte finish, right? You want to microwave it to a high gloss. This microwave we have at home is 1985 vintage. It's a Panasonic, a 23-year-old microwave. So we have to set it on 19 seconds to get the appropriate lift. What you want to do is get that nice sheen on top and microwave it until the center almost explodes. Then you have a real treat. Well, moon pies have a sort of a kinship with one of my favorite dishes in Appalachia, and that's the pepperoni roll. I don't know if anybody here has ever had a pepperoni roll, but it's one of those things that never really traveled very far outside the area where it was created. And that's a real shame, because when you microwave, that's a cross-section, a pepperoni roll, and that grease just starts leaking into that slightly sweetened bread, you have one of the world's best convenience foods ever. We talk about the pepperoni roll in my Appalachian Foodways class. Like the moon pie, it came out of the coal mining culture. It came out of the Italian bakeries of northern West Virginia as something coal miners could carry down underground in a lunch pail. In that class, we also talk about the mountaineers' abhorrence of governmental imposition and interference. And the pepperoni roll is a classic example of that. These have been made in northern West Virginia by Italian bakeries for a long time. Well, along about 1987, the USDA got involved in pepperoni roll issues and determined, believe it or not, that these Italian bakeries were, in fact, meat packers. The pepperoni roll, you know, put back together, you can't see the pepperoni inside the roll. But that's USDA government-inspected pepperoni in there anyway. Well, government couldn't understand that the meat had already been inspected. So the USDA attempted to reclassify all these Italian bakeries as meat packers, which would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to install drains and concrete floors and that kind of thing. So Senator Jay Rockefeller in 1987 had to intervene to save the West Virginia pepperoni roll. I am so happy to live in a region of the country where macaroni and cheese is a vegetable. If you don't believe that classification, go to Montgomery, Alabama, sit down at Martha Hawkins' table. Right there is her menu. Wednesday and Friday, vegetables, collard, steam rice, broccoli casserole, squash casserole, macaroni and cheese. Yeah. Southern food culture is so rich and so fascinating. Places like this. Yeah, I almost got caught up in a drug deal taking this picture in Indianola, Mississippi, in the worst part of town. But I had to stop that car and capture Yuck's Food Market. People think the Mississippi Delta is all black and white. Well, there are lots of Asians there. It's a very diverse population, and there you see the influence of the Chinese in the grocery store. Also in that part of Mississippi, which is a fascinating place to travel in, you find the Coolickle. These are in the Double Quick convenience stores all through the Delta. And what it is a dill pickle marinated in Kool-Aid. You drain all the brine out of the jar, make double-strength Kool-Aid, and slice your pickle so it'll marinate well, and marinate the pickle in Kool-Aid, and you have the Coolickle. That happens to be the tropical fruit variety, which we did get down. Things in the South like Hot Guts in Elgin, Texas. That's just a beef sausage, but you love the name. Been made there since the 1880s. These folks have given away $1 million worth of crackers just to taste these Hot Guts. Barbecued spaghetti in Memphis came out of the confluence of the barbecue houses and the Italians in 1940s World War II era cooking. So just about every barbecue house, Memphis people tell me if I'm wrong, that you go into in Memphis has a side dish called barbecue spaghetti. Down in Bourbon, Mississippi, you know, we Southern people love to fry everything. We fry Twinkies. At this little place, which is an old commissary in the middle of a cotton field in Bourbon, Mississippi, you will find deep-fried hot tamales. River mush in North Carolina speaks of our Southern heritage in several ways. It's a cousin to scrapple that traveled from Pennsylvania down into the North Carolina Piedmont. It's a marriage of pigs and corn. John Edgerton in Southern Food said, when those English pigs met Native American corn in Virginia in 1607, Southern cooking was born. Well, there you have that combination in liver mush, hog liver, and cornmeal. Fed the mill workers in the Piedmont of North Carolina. If you go to the Cleveland County Fairgrounds there in Shelby, you can buy a liver mush biscuit. Go to Boone Drug in Boone, North Carolina. You can buy a liver mush omelet. Now, let's get into Appalachia. You know, I celebrate food all over the South. Bulldozer rolls in northern Florida, chicken mull in Georgia, white barbecue sauce in North Alabama, Mississippi hot tamales, Tennessee country ham, Kentucky burgoo, dry land fish in Virginia, you name it. But I concentrate my work in southern Appalachia, and this is the lower end of Appalachia, in Corinth, Mississippi. Another one of those dishes that didn't travel very far outside the area where it was created. And you can guess why. You know, we laugh about the slug burger, but the slug burger reminds us of creativity in hard times. Taking meat and stretching it and making it go as far as you possibly can. And despite the fact that the Slug Burger Festival has a snail, this anthropomorphic snail with the teeth and tongue on the logo, there's no snail in a slug burger. This is a combination of meat and stretchers of various kinds served with mustard, pickle, and onion on a bun. And the term came from the fact that, a long time ago, slug was slang for a nickel. Some people also theorize that if you eat too many of them, you feel like you've been slugged in the stomach. Now, a lot of the places I go to will never make the Food Network. That's all right. I was doing a hamburger pizza. One of my students said, you got to go to this little place. You see the weathered old Pepsi sign there. Garbage bags out front. Pretty run-down looking place in Hampton, Tennessee, not far from one of the most beautiful lakes in America, Watauga. Walk into this place, and I meet the hamburger lady of Hampton, Teresa Holden. And she's a poster lady for what we're all about in this region. Never giving up, persisting, staying at it. Comes in every day, 7 days a week, before daylight, works till after dark, making those hamburgers for the people in Hampton, Tennessee. She never gave up. She'd been flooded out twice. Her husband died, but she's still there every day, making bread-stretched hamburgers, and she's proud of it. There's a place in my hometown in Greenville, Tennessee that does bread-stretched hamburgers, and they're ashamed of that. They shouldn't be. Teresa's very proud of that fact, that she learned that technique from her mother in the depths of the Great Depression, and she continues it. If any of you know Roane County, Tennessee, here's a lady who keeps at it. She's in her 80s. She's my favorite pizza maker in all the world. Her name is Lottie O'Brien. Actually, Lisa Latta. I love quirky things, incongruity in food. Lisa Latta O'Brien is a German lady who married an Irishman, and she makes Italian pizza on the banks of Watts Bar Lake in Kingston, Tennessee. She comes in every day and does that, makes the dough from scratch, makes the sauce from scratch. She makes Italian sausage from scratch. She makes sauerkraut pizza. And when the jukebox went out a couple of summers ago, I was in there, one of the waitresses said, everything in this place is breaking down but Lottie. Arnold Burpsey Zandi was one of East Tennessee's most notable hot dog vendors. He would walk up and down the steps at Neyland Stadium in Knoxville, Tennessee during football games, and in Stokely Athletic Center and later Thompson Bowling during basketball games. Arnold was also a political candidate, ran for every conceivable office imaginable as an independent, never took campaign contribution, and always lost. But instead of yelling out something boring and predictable like hot dogs, cold drinks, his saying was, "Erpsies and burpsies and yummies for the tummy." And I love that photograph. There he is in an Olympian pose with the expanse of Neyland Stadium behind him hawking hot dogs. Now, I'm going to play you just a few short audio cuts. I love voices. I love accents. I love dialects. And one of the absolute best food interviews I ever did was with this lady in Knoxville, Tennessee, Clara Robinson, who runs a tamale shop on Magnolia in an old beauty shop. And I'm asking here about something I notice on the wall.
Tell me about this vegetarian tamale you have listed on the wall.
Okay, you know I got this one particular customer. He used to come in all the time. Clara, do you? Why don't you sell vegetarian tamales? Now, what is a vegetarian tamale? I'm asking him. He said it's a tamale that has no real meat, he says. You know, that beef and stuff. So I told him, well, I'll give it a try. You ready to sell? He said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll supply all you need for the first batch. And he did. And you know, the vegetarian tamale, it comes with that soybean stuff. Well, you know, it's grainy. You know, but once you mix it up, it looks just like meat. But it's not meat. You know, and I, with me seasoning it up the way it's supposed to be, you can't hardly tell the difference. I know the difference. So it's made not more or less out of it.
One of the best lines I've ever heard. It's made out of whatever it is vegetarians eat. I walked in cold with a recorder and sat down and talked to her. She never told me, don't print this. She was very open and honest. I love her Mississippi Delta accent, which she kept. Although she followed the trail of the blues. She grew up in Greenville, Mississippi. I have to think Greenwood or Greenville. Greenville on the river during Jim Crow segregation, had to go north to Chicago, like the blues, in order to find a job, and eventually settled back in Knoxville, Tennessee, where her sister had worked for Knoxville College. And her sister's now deceased. Clara keeps the name of her sister on the business and makes these Mississippi Delta-style hot tamales, which are made with cornmeal, ground beef, and tamale paper, not corn shucks. I mentioned a poster lady for Appalachian Foodways. Another one, and one of my favorite people in all the world, was Jeanette Carter, the daughter of AP and Sarah from Scott County, Virginia. And I had the good fortune to be able to sit down at Sarah's elbow several years ago and watch her make chow chow, that garden clearing relish that we spoon onto soup beans. And what really struck me about that was not the flavor of the chow chow, although we still can't explain how chow chow got into that part of Southwest Virginia with its exotic spicing. But what really spoke to me about that scene was the fact that although the Carters were internationally known, Jeanette would get media calls daily. She stayed in that home. She stayed close to her roots, her raising. She never forgot who she was. When Jill, my wife, was in elementary school there in Scott County, and this was the time when Johnny Cash made the Carter name very well known, Jeanette was still working in an elementary school cafeteria, spooning out soup beans and plunging her hand down into a sleeve of white bread, putting that bread on students' plates. Never forgotten that. That's her old chow chow recipe in that book right there. Jeanette once called former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher honey. And I have to think she willed this. When we went to her memorial service at the Carter Family Fold, a live music venue not far from where A.P. Carter's store was there near Mesa Spring, Virginia, we walked in that Sunday for the memorial service, and you know what? The concession stand was open. Well, here's some more Carter family lore that very few people know about. Those are the hands of Teresa Jett, whose husband Dale is the son of Jeanette. He's the grandson of AP and Sarah Carter. The Carters, at Thanksgiving and Christmas, don't necessarily eat ham and turkey and biscuits and the things you might think would come out of a Scott County kitchen. What they eat is ravioli, handmade ravioli. How did that come to be? In the 30s, when AP and Sarah split up, and Sarah took up with AP's first cousin, Coy Bays, and went to California, they lived next to an Italian family and learned to appreciate ravioli. Got the recipe. That's Sarah Carter's old ravioli roller right there that's still used today. The first family of country music. Absolutely the best ravioli I have ever had. The stuffing is chicken and cheese and spinach and garlic. And the sauce is more chicken, beef, mushrooms, tomatoes out of the garden. Jeanette, I won't say exactly what Jeanette said about the filling, but she said, you know that the filling is right when it looks like goose droppings. Well, this recipe resonated with the Carters because it reminded the family of the tomato dumplings that they had eaten in the mountains. I love stories that bring together food and music. This is the Ciderville Music Store in Powell, Tennessee. It looks like a fireworks stand. Where the gimmick is, they sell more Martin guitars than any place in America. The gimmick is to give away free vegetable soup every Thursday. So you go in there, go all the way to the back. There's these cheap 2-liter drinks, pillars of saltine crackers, and Faye West, whose brother runs the place, back there dipping out free vegetable soup. They don't advertise any other way but that. David West played for a man named Kaz Walker. And Kaz Walker's legacy lives on at this little music store in Powell, Tennessee. Kaz, if you don't know about him, was certainly the most colorful grocer ever to come out of these mountains. He was born in Sevier County. He saved $800 from working in a coal mine and started a chain of grocery stores. Kaz Walker, sign of the shears, long before that little smiley guy with Walmart and his sword, Kaz had the sign of the shears. He was a coon hunter, so you see graves of his coon dogs behind him. And I could tell you Kaz stories all day. But I want you to hear his voice. First of all, listen to how he butchers the English language. He's hawking a product that's still sold right there today called Superderm Salve. Listen to the claims he makes for Superderm Salve.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Kaz Walker. I operate a chain of supermarkets in East Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia. I had the most tormenting condition that anyone ever had. And I went to John Hopkins, and I went to many of the clinics over the country without relief. Then I found the wonderful miracle Superderm Salve. Now, for all itchy conditions, I want to recommend Superderm Salve. Athlete's foot, hemorrhoids, acne, old sores that refuse to heal. This is not a snake oil or cure-all, but we do guarantee the relief, or your money will be carefully refunded. Mail $1.25 to Kaz Walker, Post Box 9090, Knoxville, Tennessee.
That is my home and my home.
Imagine something that would take care of acne and hemorrhoids. He had the continuum covered there. Kaz had this strategy of getting him all. If he did it today, he'd be censored by every animal rights group imaginable. He would take live chickens up to the roof of one of his grocery stores and throw those chickens off the roof, and if you caught the chicken, you could take the chicken home and cook it. Kaz did some wild stuff. He got Dolly Parton started, to his great credit. I mean, he was a great supporter of country music, got Dolly Parton started. He had a live radio program and a live television program in Knoxville. This is probably the most famous photograph of Kaz Walker ever taken. March 6, 1956. Kaz was a politician. He was on the city council in Knoxville. He was right out of the rough and tumble 19th century populist political tradition. He was again everything that people would define as progressive. He fought the fluoridation of the water supply in Knoxville because he thought it was a communist plot. He fought the formation of metro government. He fought the coming of the World's Fair, which occurred in 1982. Right here in the middle of this city commission meeting, he's in a fist fight with his former buddy Jim Cooper. What they were fighting about was the peanut and popcorn concession at Chilhowie Park. That picture made Life magazine. And in the late 70s, when people were trying to prove that the, quote, scruffy little city of Knoxville, Tennessee did not deserve a World's Fair, that picture resurfaced a lot of places. Mount Airy, North Carolina. Fast food for 1923. The snappy lunch. That's Mr. Charles Dowell. He serves a bread burger, too. But on the other end of the menu is this Baroque sandwich. It's the most understated name I've ever seen. He simply calls it a pork sandwich. But see how it's leaking out the bun there, and it's dressed with chili and onions and tomatoes and slaw and mustard? This is where Andy Griffith grew up, as you probably well know. And Mr. Dowell bought this business in 1960, and he was, as he said, laying on the couch one night watching the Andy Griffith Show, seventh episode. The only time a snappy lunch was ever mentioned by name on the Andy Griffith Show. But this was pre-Thelma Lou, when Andy was trying to fix Barney up with a seamstress there, Miss Rosemary, and wanted to take her and Barney to the snappy lunch to sit and drink and chat. All right, you're in Kingsport, Tennessee. You got to know about this guy, Frederick Powell Barger. Kingsport, Tennessee is home to two Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award winning businesses. One is Eastman Chemical Company. The other is Powell's. And even if you're from the other side of the state, you've driven around a little bit here, you've probably seen one of these garish structures. That's what a typical Powell's looks like. It's not Appalachian food, but certainly it's an Appalachian food phenomenon. We have people from all over the world coming in here to Kingsport to learn the management philosophy and techniques of this business that won a Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. Union Square Restaurant Group in Manhattan. Bunch of New York restaurateurs heads down here to Kingsport to learn about this little hamburger stand. There were a number of Blue Circle restaurants in the South from about 1932 on into the 60s and 70s. There's one still around in Bristol, Tennessee. That one's been around since the early 1960s. And we joke a lot about hamburger flippers. These are college-educated hamburger flippers. He has a degree in marketing from UT. She's an English and journalism graduate from Emory and Henry College. They take pride in flipping those hamburgers, and they sell about 30,000 of those little crystal-style hamburgers every month. People ask me, what makes a good restaurant? That makes a good restaurant, the presence of the owners. Up in Scott County, Virginia, you can visit an out-of-the-way place called, informally, the Yuma Mall, McGee's General Merchandise. They have everything from a hairdo to hardware to hamburgers. And like so many of the places I've written about, it started out at the worst possible time, right in the middle of the Great Depression, and it survives today. At the confluence of two railroad lines there in Scott County, people call in orders from trains. This little place almost wrote itself. It's in the Willie Boom community of Bristol, Tennessee. It's called Tootie's, and it serves Arville Burgers. Now, opened in 1945, Tootie Vance whistled all the time when he was a kid, so he got that nickname. Came back after World War II, started selling penny candy in that little building that looks like a cab stand. I asked his son Arville, who created the Arville Burger, that's a burger with onions inside it, if he'd ever been written about before. Business started in 1945. Nobody had the sense to sit down and talk to these people about the history of the place until we did that. There are still a few drugstores around that serve food. One of them is in Gate City, Virginia, where you can get pimento cheese, macaroni salad, hamburgers. Think of the time when B.J. Broadwater went to pharmacy school back in the 40s. He got all that fancy education and had to go back to his mother's kitchen and learn how to make pimento cheese. Well, you're in the Red Hot Dog Quarter. There's a little spur of it over in Boone, North Carolina, where people love to grill those red hot dogs until they're just black. They split them. They go to Little Hilltop Drive-In or Boone Drug and say, burn it. I got in all kinds of hot water with a PhD in Bristol one time for writing about these red hot dogs. But these red hot dogs are a part of the culture here. They kept families going. I did some red hot dog economics the other day at Walmart. You know, the unit cost of the hot dog is less than the unit cost of the bun. Well, that's what they look like. And up in Wytheville, Virginia, a little place called Skeeters, you got this very plebeian red hot dog business juxtaposed against the birthplace of the second Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, very patrician lady, born in that building where they now sell red hot dogs. I was doing a talk at the mental institution in Marion, Virginia, to the staff. And a lady walks up and says, "You've got to go to the Dip Dog." Okay, I went to the Dip Dog. 50 years in business last year, serving not corn dogs, but these red hot dogs that are speared with a stick, dipped in a batter, deep fried, and bathed in mustard. The Dip Dog. And same rule, these people take 1 week off a year. They're there all the time. There's a family in Newport, Tennessee that has the guts to run a restaurant called the Grease Rack. And it's one of the best steakhouses in America. It's one of these places that used to be a private club. You had to have a car to get in. So even now, you know, they told me, we got caught too many times for selling the illegal liquor, so we got to have a liquor business, beer only. Walk in the front door and you're bathed in this bluish-green light. And you push the button. And not to present a card or membership, they just want to make sure you are worthy of eating at a place called the Grease Rack. And that's what the steak looks like. The steaks are named for people. That's a Harold special, because Harold, the maintenance man who worked at the Stokely Van Camp plant down the street, loved onions. So they cover the onion, the steak with onions. Earl didn't like onions, so the Earl special has none. And the Wormy steak is named for a skinny guy down at the fire hall who eats a 2.5-inch steak every week. In Johnson City, Tennessee, one of the oldest restaurants in Tennessee is the Peerless, which opened in 1938. It started out as a barbecue place. Now it's an all-American steakhouse. The lesson there is how Greeks adapted their cooking styles to meet Southern tastes. Any medium to large city in the South has a Greek-owned restaurant. They may not serve avgolomena soup. They may not serve souvlaki. But they're Greek-owned and very proud of that fact. And this is the case with the Peerless, which opened in 1938, as I mentioned, in that building. Well, how did it convert from barbecue stand to steakhouse? John Kalogris, a Greek immigrant, came to Johnson City from South Carolina, opened up that place as a barbecue joint, and he figured he would be pretty safe in betting on the University of Tennessee 1939 football team. They went undefeated that year. In fact, nobody scored a point on them all year long. Got into the Rose Bowl. They got beat. John lost his bet, had to serve his friends steak dinners, and that's how the Peerless became a steakhouse. Probably the first time feta cheese was ever served at a restaurant here in Northeast Tennessee. And that's John's son, Jim, who's 80-some years old, still water skiing on Boone Lake and still coming in every day watching over that restaurant. People like Jim, I mean, are made of strong stuff. You know, he's got all kinds of physical ailments, but he doesn't let those ailments keep him out of that kitchen. Down in Chattanooga, anybody know Zarzur's Cafe? Quite a story there, too. This may be the oldest restaurant in Tennessee. The Regus claims that. It opened in 1919, but it closed for a little while. I think you can easily say this is one of the oldest restaurants in continuous operation by the same family. And again, it's a story of ethnic assimilation. The family came from what we now call Lebanon. And panhandled in Alabama, finally settled in Chattanooga. What happened worldwide 100 years ago this year? The great influenza pandemic. Charlie Zarzur's wife bought him that little building there in Chattanooga, and then she died of the flu and left him there with a bunch of children. So he started serving hamburgers and Cokes and beer and popcorn, and that eventually evolved into a palace of Southern cooking. There's not a stuffed cabbage roll on the menu, not a kibbe on the menu. Look at the stove, look at the plate. Butter beans and greens and roast beef on a piece of white bread. Now, these folks may go home and cook Middle Eastern, but they cook Southern fare in Chattanooga. And there's Mr. Charlie's naturalization certificate. They're very proud of that. It's on the wall of the restaurant. In Knoxville, Tennessee, speaking of immigrant cooking, let me read you what I wrote about this little place. It's called King Tut's Grill. I was there, by the way, the week King Tut had his CAT scan. So Egyptian nationalism was running pretty high there. Wednesdays on Egyptian night, in between bites of stuffed grape leaves and spoons of fava beans, diners at King Tut's Grill beat toy bongos, toot kazoos, and dance the Macarena under disco lights. Owner Monir Girga shoots rubber chickens with toy guns and stuffs them in styrofoam takeout boxes. Soft drinks are served in flower vases brought in from flea markets by customers. It's a Cairo karaoke roadhouse run by Christian Orthodox Coptics in the Vestal community of South Knoxville, Tennessee. Talk about incongruity. All right, let's talk a little bit about barbecue. Southern Living Magazine is going to get two rather strong hits today. Several years ago, Southern Living did a barbecue magazine in the middle of the summer. The article was written by someone from Memphis, which I understand. But that someone from Memphis never got past Knoxville. The only Knoxville barbecue place he wrote about was a chain. Never touched our beloved Ridgewood Barbecue here in Bluff City, Tennessee. This place celebrates 60 years in business this year, still in the same family. What they barbecue, that's a classic mountain hollow right there. It backs right up to a hill. What they barbecue is not pork shoulder. They barbecue fresh ham. It's the only cut of pork. Over hickory wood, outside in a pit, not with gas or electricity. They rub that down with a spice rub, chill it, slice it, and then warm it up on a grill with this wonderful tomato-based barbecue sauce. What sociologist John Shelton Reed said of that sauce is this: it's what ketchup will taste like in heaven. That's the owner on the left, the late Grace Prophet, her daughter Lisa on the right. Lisa's an RN. Her father, Larry, who helps her with the business, is a pharmacist. Got to feel pretty good about the health code there when the healthcare professionals are running a barbecue joint. Well, this is what Larry Prophet said about this barbecue sauce as a rite of passage in his family.
After my brother died, we were closed for 10 days. We came over here and my daughter says, I said, we're going to make sauce. I'm going to teach you the recipe. 2 years ago, my brother said, we need to teach Lisa the recipe. And I said, no, it's not time yet. So we came over here that afternoon. And on Sunday afternoon, everything was closed. And I wrote the recipe down for her. She said, do you really remember the recipe? And I said, do you remember your Social Security number? I've known this recipe since I was 16. And so I said, it's been in my head. And I said, that's what's in your head. I said, you memorize it. Well, when we started out, I made 30 gallons of sauce. And she was memorizing. And I said, do you have it now? And she says, oh, yeah, I mean that. I said, now write it down. You write it down for me. And she wrote the recipe down. It's a pretty long recipe. And so she wrote all of it down. Then I went outside and I got me a pack of matches. And I brought it back over the sink and turned the water on. And I struck a match to the recipes, and I said, there goes your recipe. And she said, hope it's in your head, because it's only in mine and yours now. And so there it resides. The next generation.
You've got to be old enough to have the right to learn that recipe. And it's like an antique piece of furniture handed down from one family member to another. Well, John Shelton Reed also said about Southern barbecue, it's like Europe's wines and cheeses. Drive 100 miles and the barbecue changes. And that's true. You go to Shelby, North Carolina, to a place like Bridges, you're not going to get fresh ham. You're going to get shoulder. The sauce is a little more sour, a little more tart, a little less tomato in it. The slaw does not have mayonnaise in it. It has some ketchup, some hot sauce, some vinegar. The side dish there on the right is hush puppies. This is a barbecue place that has always been run by women. Look at the woodpile out and back. Across town at Red Bridges Barbecue, men have always been in charge. Look at their woodpile. Southerners fight about barbecue because it's such a localized thing. You know, it can really start some serious arguments, like Brunswick stew. Look at that National Geographic article from 1994. Three states are fighting about who discovered Brunswick stew. Go up into Virginia, you find a historical plaque in Brunswick County, Virginia, indicating that it began right there. And there's a Stew Masters Association. One of them said, a good Brunswick stew must be cooked down slowly. In Brunswick County, Virginia, you know the stew is done when the stirring paddle stands straight up in the pot. Anything else is soup and is probably from Georgia. Well, a lot of our food here came out of hard times, like red-eye gravy. Drippings, leavings in a skillet, water. Maybe a little leftover coffee if you want to get fancy with it. My absolute favorite restaurant in the world is that one. That's an original location. It's moved in my hometown of Greenville, Tennessee. My favorite restaurant has no valet parking, has nobody standing at one of those little square things that light up, telling you your table's ready. Nobody says, I'll be taking care of you today. No china, no silver, no crystal, none of that. It's a restaurant that stayed true to the emblematic dish of the southern Appalachian Mountains, soup beans. Romy and Zella Maybritt started it in the 1940s. There it is today. Creaky floors, about 9 layers of linoleum you can see down through, no covers on the light bulbs. You walk in there and you're treated to beans all the way. What Romy and Zella May did was to combine two dishes that had been cooking on mountain stovetops a long time, beef stew and soup beans, lard seasoned soup beans, topped with chopped onions, paired with buttermilk and cornbread. I say, I'm amazed some Manhattan hotshot hasn't discovered that, slapped a French name on it, served it in a ramekin for about $15 a shot. $1.99 a bowl at the Bean Barn, still today. Well, it's ramp season here in northeast Tennessee. I have to mention those. The Wild Mountain Leek. And I went on a ramp dig about a year ago, one of the greatest days of my life, and that's what they look like from Unicoi County, Tennessee. And most people don't realize that we owe a great debt to the Native Americans, the Cherokees, for teaching us about the ramp. Cherokees believe that when you sat and were less active in the wintertime, your blood got thick. It pooled in your body and needed to be thinned down. And something pungent like that ramp off the forest floor was necessary to thin that blood down. And you still get stories about kids being sent home from school with ramp reek on their breath. So it's always been a mark of shame on the one hand. But it teaches us a lot about our mountain culture, too. And it's becoming, I guess, unfortunately, trendy food. I got an invitation last spring to the James Beard Awards Gala in Manhattan. Black tie, $450 a plate. First thing on the menu was ramps. Okay, let me wrap up here with a drink and a couple of sweet things, and we'll be done. If you stop somewhere at a convenience store on your way back home to Middle and West Tennessee, you might see Dr. Enough. This is our very unique soft drink made in Johnson City since the late 1940s. It was the first energy drink. It really has its feet in 3 centuries. It's very much out of the 19th century patent medicine tradition. It was created by Charles Gordon in the late 1940s, and now it's marketed in the 21st century as a new age nutraceutical. Charlie bought the formula from a chemist in Chicago whose co-workers were complaining about being tired all the time. It's loaded with caffeine and vitamin B complex. Well, Charlie Gordon was a marketing genius. This took off so quickly in the late 40s that it had to be rationed. And what he did was he bought full-page ads in the newspapers in Northeast Tennessee, had that ad designed to look like a news story. He paid the newspaper carriers to fold the paper backwards so it looked like front-page news. Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia is an epicenter of pure sugar stick candy making. A very simple candy that was sometimes poor children's only Christmas. And there's at one time in the 20th century, there were 10 different candy companies in Bristol operating. Now there's just a handful. And this little place, talk about obscure, it's on the Tennessee side of Bristol, and it's dungeon-like. The only sign outside says reserved for radiologists. It's Ratliff Candy Company. And Ken and Mike Ratliff, his father and son, in that little dark building, keep the 50-plus year tradition going of making candy cane baskets. Sell more of those baskets to California people than they do to Tennesseans. It's hand work. It's work a lot of people don't want to do anymore, but they are keeping at it. I'm going to mention dried apple stack cake as a conclusion, but I can't leave this presentation without noting the 230th anniversary of this business, the oldest business in Tennessee, in Watauga. Not very far from where the Watauga Association, the first independent government in America, was formed. This mill survived the coming of the Yankees and the coming of the Walmart. It survived the Civil War because it was used as a church. It no longer mills food for human consumption. They make their money now primarily with horse feed. But at one time in the early 20th century, there were about 20 mills in Washington County. And that's, as far as I know, the only one that's still in business. 230 years this year. Now, my concluding story is about dried apple stack cake. If soup, beans, and cornbread represent the iconic main meal in Appalachia, perhaps the iconic dessert would be dried apple stack cake, one you rarely see in restaurants. And this is my wife's family recipe. It's in the first place setting book. If you want to make it, make sure you use white lily flour, by the way. White lily is, the name has been bought by Smucker's, and it pains me to know that white lily flour will no longer be made in Knoxville, Tennessee as of this summer. They'll probably make it somewhere else, but it's been made right there in Knoxville since 1883, and that will stop in a few months. Sad, sad tale in Southern food history. Anyway, this cake, with its measurements, relies on white lily flour. That's my wife's grandmother's dried apple stack cake recipe that goes back over a century. The only adornment, really, are those scalloped edges, the fork pricks, and the scattering of sugar. This is a cake that was made in the mountains for weddings, and neighbors would make layers. They would be assembled at the home of the bride. Products like sorghum syrup, eggs, buttermilk, right off the farm. Here's my second hit on Southern Living. Southern Living came up and talked to us about Appalachian food one spring. And we mentioned apple stack cake. The writer got very interested, turned that idea over to the test kitchen. Over half of the subscribers to Southern Living magazine live outside the South. In my opinion, you get a very distorted portrait of the South if you depend on Southern Living. Well, this is not quickie cooking. This takes all day. It takes a long time to boil the dried apples, to make the cake. Then you have to let it sit 3 days. And mountain children would get into trouble for cutting into the cake too early. It's got to sit 3 days and cure. If you want to think about the origin of it, it's very close to a Central European tort. So I think it has German, has a German pedigree. Well, it got into the hands of the young folks at Seven Living who tried to make quickie cooking out of it. And it was published in the magazine with her name on it still. The original recipe has no spicing in it, not even vanilla, no cinnamon, none of that stuff. It's a very unadorned recipe. It doesn't need the spicing. They put spicing in there. The layers look like crackers. The filling is chunky instead of smooth. Needless to say, her family in Scott County, Virginia was very bothered by that. And I think what the magazine did was, you know, unethical. That's what it should look like. Now, the irony of this story is that Southern Living Magazine, published in Birmingham, Alabama, screwed it up. We got an email from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They wanted to do a fundraiser for Southern Foodways. They wanted to serve this recipe. Look at it. They did it right. That's the dried apple stack cake out of our kitchen before it starts to cure. People think they've got to mess with this recipe. We had a reception on the campus one time. The chef at ETSU was from West Virginia, so we thought, surely this guy knows about stack cake. We gave him the recipe. We gave him samples of her cake. He calls about 2 hours before the event and says, what kind of sauce do you serve with this stack cake? So anyway, she's the only granddaughter who makes this storied cake. And to me, that captures the spirit of the mountains better than anything. Does anybody have any questions or comments or recipes or other uses for a microwave oven? Yeah. Most of them are, yeah. The book consists of two different volumes. The first one came out in 2006, the second one 2007. The third one will be out in a year. A few of the places will be in the third one, such as The Dip Dog. Dr. Enough will be in the third one. But yeah, those two books largely coincide with this presentation, which documents Southern food culture. And I can't close today without saying a word of thanks to my colleagues at the University of Mississippi and the Southern Foodways Alliance, who in 1998 began to help me appreciate the richness I had grown up around, because we had been cooking Iranian food and Italian food and Greek and Hungarian and French and German and Indian and all sorts of things, which are wonderful. But we had ignored the black iron skillet. And I thank the people at Ole Miss for bringing me back to that pegboard wall where those 100-year-old black iron skillets hang in my kitchen. Exactly. And the people of Ann Arbor asked that very question. They said, when this cake was originally made, would it have had lard in it? And we said, absolutely. Thank you all very much.
And I don't know about all of you, but I'm so glad we ate before this presentation, because it made me hungry again. And just for your information, there are books. His books are outside. And if you haven't bought them already, you can buy them, and he will be glad to autograph them for you after this presentation. So thank you all for coming.